That's a really big question.
This is Sunday Nights.
I do not believe that the world was created in 7 days, 6,000 years ago.
On ABC Local Radio.
Hi there, great to have you with us. Well, it's the week before Christmas, and perhaps, just perhaps, the world has something to celebrate. Last week, despite all the reservations, the nations of the world reached an historic agreement in Paris over climate change. Not only did they agree on the discussed target of a maximum 2 degrees of global warming, but committed themselves to aspire to a target of 1.5 degrees. In what has been an almost unprecedented coalition of the sacred and secular, the opinions of scientists, matched by the ethical force of the world's major religious traditions, led by Pope Francis in his climate encyclical Laudate Si, have perhaps set the stage for real change. Well, tonight we bring together a number of Australians who've been watching events quite closely, including one who was present in Paris. So what does Paris mean for Australia and most particularly our neighbours in the Pacific? Well, joining us to explore this and related questions, it's a pleasure to welcome into the studios one of our frequent guests, Dr. Miriam Pepper of the Uniting Earth Web. Miriam, good to have you with us once again.
Good to be here.
In our Perth studio, Gerard Sierro, an environmental architect and member of the Anglican EcoCare Commission. Gerard, welcome to you.
Hello, John.
Also in our Sydney studio, the Reverend Dr. Seth Carroll, the Uniting World's Manager of Church Partnerships for the Pacific. Seth.
Hello.
Welcome and congratulations on achieving your PhD, I believe, awarded this week.
Yes, yes.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, it's good to have you with fresh out of the stable. You're ready to take up the cudgels and run. And finally, almost direct from Paris, Phil Glendenning of the Edmund Rice Centre in Sydney and President of the Refugee Council of Australia. Phil, thanks for joining us.
John, thank you.
And Phil, I guess the first question has got to come to you. It's the question that everybody's asked you since you got off the plane. How was the experience of Paris?
Well, it was chaotic. It was inspirational in parts. It was certainly exhausting. But it was all, I guess, initially in the shadow of the events of November 13, in a city that was traumatised by what had occurred to its citizens not very far from Le Bourget, where we were based.
Did it serve to distract people or to focus people?
No, I think it served to focus and sharpen people's sense of the importance of humanity coming together to do something in order to save humanity. It was very different to Copenhagen and Cancun, the previous COPs that I've attended, and I think the atmosphere was such that people came, you know, determined to try and get to a point where there was a pathway out and some hope was on the table. People were traumatised. You know, hardened French journalists would weep just describing what the events of the city were like. And for people to come into that particular atmosphere was quite different, quite unique. But I think the roller coaster ride to the result. If you'd asked me on the Tuesday, the first week, I would have thought, you know, any mention of 1.5 degree of global warming would be a pipe dream. Any commitment from larger countries to forego their credits for the gain from their Kyoto commitments, but that you would have thought that's not going to happen. Then it looked like a clash between those who were afraid of seeing a slight dip in their GDP from the developed world, with those that are looking right down the barrel of the existential threat to their survival. You know, President Tong from Kiribati put this very eloquently. He said to an assembly of Western leaders, well, what do you prefer? What do you think's worse? You have a slight drop in your GDP, or I don't have a home and my people don't have a country.
And in the middle of that, you had countries like India, who people were saying, will they or won't they, because their own economic self-interest may dictate something else.
Yeah, and India was saying things like, well, it's fine for you to be talking about all that sort of stuff, but in our colonial history, we were denied access to energy because we were under the thumb of an oppressed, occupying colonial power who developed on the backs of us. So, you know, there were stark differences in that first week, but by the end of it, an excellent way that the French were able to bring people together. We got a result that was not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but that I think is good.
One other question before I open it up, and we'll have a general discussion about the how it went. Many people expressed surprise that the conference as a whole was willing to concede to the Americans that you couldn't really nail targets to the wall that were going to be enforceable, because the Americans had already said, we're not going to be able to get that through our Congress. Yeah. So there was a recognition of political reality there as well.
Yeah, there was. And I think for those who were wedded to the fact that only legally binding things are valuable, well, those things that are going to be legally binding tend to be very modest. And the fact is, the reality is that the Americans were never going to get this through the Senate when it came to issues of loss and damage or compensation or anything in terms of assisting the developing world. Mm. And there was an understanding, a reality there, that the binding parts here are the process and the mechanisms going forward. Whilst the commitments are not binding, they are nevertheless able to encourage countries to pursue more serious targets. Mm. And they have to report every 5 years. I mean, the five-yearly review is probably one of the best things to come out of it, plus access to funding much needed for the poorest, most vulnerable countries on the planet. We have to see whether that money will flow, but nevertheless having that on the table is important, as is the fact that we've got a standalone mechanism for loss and damage for countries like Tuvalu, who say, well, you know, $100 billion for adaptation, that's good, but what if our country is awash with water? What's there going to be to adapt? So there has to be some support for loss and damage for what's already happening. And I was just saying the others before I went to Paris, I was in Tuvalu, and came out of a meeting one morning to see the entire area in front of the building I was in near the runway completely immersed in water, three or four rugby fields wide. And stupidly, as the Australian, I sort of said, oh, someone's left the tap on, this was off the hose on. And they looked at me with a wry, sardonic smile and said, no, it's high tide. And you could see the water bubbling up through the earth like these little springs, because the tide had come in 150 metres away and had come in under the earth and was pushing the water up. So the 1.5 is not going to help them, but serious funding, serious support for loss and damage, serious options to access to other places will. All of that was put on the table in Paris, and that's a good thing.
Seth, I'd like to come to you later in much more detail on this, but you've experienced Tuvalu yourself with that sort of condition, haven't you?
Yes, I have, and it was a very disconcerting experience. But for me, it was the reality of feeling like you're living on borrowed time, and just knowing that this island doesn't have much. Well, depending on which scientists you speak to, but it doesn't have that long to go. So, and the sad reality is that because people live with this every day, they know it's happening, but the reality is so great that they've actually just gone into emotional, psychological shutdown. Mm. And sadly, though, it then kicks into a default theological position that says that God will save, that Noah's Ark will come back again. And so we've got, in terms of dealing not only with the physical environment and what's actually happening, it's also the psychological, emotional and spiritual.
Yes, when people feel under threat, they reach for apocalyptic solutions.
Absolutely.
And I'd like to come back to some of those issues a little later on. But Miriam Pepper, if I can come to you now. Sitting there listening to Phil, you're somebody who's been pursuing a lot of this stuff for many, many years. Are there any observations or questions you have of Phil? But first, your observations.
Yeah, so this was the 21st Conference of the Parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. So this has been going on since 1995, a very long time. A lot of the expressions that are coming out of the different movements who've been involved for many years and some more recently as well is to say that we are so happy that we have these targets now on the table for temperature increase. So that represents such a big step forward from where we've been in the past, and to have all nations agreeing to that. So that's been, really strongly from the different groups. There have been criticisms about other things, so the lack of concrete emission reduction targets, pathways to get there and so on. But I think, on the back of years of what's been perceived as failures through these conventions, this has been a real boost of hope for the different movements. I think Bill McKibben, who's a well-known climate activist from the United States and a committed Methodist, actually, He said, well, I don't think it saved the planet. It may have saved the chance to save it, was how he put it. So obviously a lot more work to do, and we all know that, but it's certainly a window of hope for everyone working on this moving forward.
Gerard Sierra, let me pick your brains on this for a moment. And just picking up what Miriam said, it almost seems as though people recognise that the achievement of Paris isn't a finality, it's more a beginning point.
Yes, I would say that that's exactly right. I think that McKibben's idea about that we've saved the chance to save, well, it's not so much the Earth will go on, but our civilization, I guess, that is what this opportunity really means. And in terms of my work with Climate Reality and our work with EcoCare and so on, I would see this now as the starting point for the real work. You know, we really have to try to make this real now. And, you know, there are still people within our society who have not changed their position in opposition to anything about this, and who believe that this is all a fairy tale or a conspiracy or something. So we have a great deal of work to do. And some of those people are about Christians. And so there's a lot of work for us to do also in expounding a theology that makes it possible for us to achieve some form of climate justice.
You brought in the issue there of the role of religious groups and the role of Christians. It was interesting that early in the year, well, the mid-year, the Pope Francis put out the document Laudato Si. And Laudato Si seems to have really... Oh, Robert Mann, the Australian political philosopher, he said to me in a discussion we broadcast here on radio a few weeks ago, he said, look, I'm an atheist Jew, but I find this a spiritually inspiring document. Phil Glendenning, you're somebody who's a member of the Catholic Church, Francis's intervention, did it resonate at all in the background static for the conference?
Well, I think it certainly resonated. There's no doubt about that. But I think what it also did, it sort of echoed very strongly in the sort of some of the language that was being used by some of the leaders of the most poor and vulnerable nations. That attention did go to those countries, and I wouldn't overplay its role and importance in those talks. But I think it was a timely coincidence. I think the Pope is certainly using the platform to make what needs to happen begin to happen, and that's obviously very welcome. But I really think the leadership that was shown by some of the poorest, most vulnerable nations on earth at Paris was the really truly remarkable thing that came out of it. Mm. They would not be bowed. You know, they would not be bowed in the face of, you know, pretty relentless power. And at the end of the day, they got their agenda, particularly Kiribati and Tuvalu, on the table.
Seth, let's talk about that and the way in which the spirituality of those nations does carry some weight with them. This is, did they feel that the issue for them was a spiritual one? You've mentioned that the underlying factors that if people don't get their own way or don't see hope in this world, they'll look for it in the next in some pretty aberrant ways at times. Yep. But was this seen as something that was in many ways for them motivated by a vision of the world, by a holistic vision? I don't want to overplay that, but I know it's been an issue that people like you have spoken about many times.
Oh, absolutely. And in the Pacific, I mean, we, somewhat like the indigenous people, where spirituality and land and ocean and environment is actually all one, it's integrated. So the loss of home is also a loss of identity and a loss of spirituality as well. So someone like the General Secretary of the Tuvalu Congregational Church, Tafui, would say that climate change is an issue of spirituality. It affects their spirituality. So in order to deal with the physical and the environment, we also have to deal with the spirituality of people. Now, in saying that, the Pacific is actually carrying a legacy of colonial theology and colonization. So a lot of work needs to be done in enabling them and empowering Pacific Islanders to rethink their understanding of God as a God who is present in the suffering and present in the wrestling with the climate change issues, present in the question of where is home if my home is going to be gone and lost. So all this is actually part of that rethinking and wrestling with where God is in the midst of all this, you know, in the midst of devastation and in the midst of what can seemingly look like gloom. So, yes, of course, spirituality, religion, faith is an important aspect of this. In the Pacific, unfortunately, we have it's actually a work that needs to be ongoing, and it's a work that we need to keep doing to help the leaders that get it, both in the secular, the government, as well as the church, to enable their communities to engage with the issue of climate change. So, yes, you know, Paris is a very hopeful document and agreement, but many of our leaders, Pacific leaders, will say, well, it's actually what happens after Paris. And they celebrate, though, their achievement that they've made at Paris. But it's going to be the long, hard work that happens after that and also the implementation of that agreement.
There are a couple of things that Paris didn't address, and people have pointed this out. Paris, Miriam, didn't go to the issue of the oceans and the warming of the oceans and how we're and the acidification of the oceans in particular. Paris wasn't able to address a number of the concrete issues. Well, somebody said it was the oceans and the air that got left out. We dealt with the land, we didn't deal with the oceans and the air. How do you feel about that stuff? What's your reservations about where we're at the moment, I guess?
Oh, look, John, I mean, a lot of reservations, I guess. I mean, and when we're talking about these issues of spirituality and holism, you know, how that kind of guilt gets dealt with in these international fora that are dealing specifically with greenhouse gases, if you like, is always going to be an issue. I mean, there's a lot of other things that didn't get dealt with as well, of course, like that the vast majority of known fossil fuel reserves will have to stay in the ground. You know, There's a whole lot of things, and that's a reality in this country too, where we've got multiple coal mining proposals on the table, and they can't go ahead if we're to meet, you know, to stay within these temperature limits. That's the reality, and that's the work.
Because the acknowledgement was we're already pushing 3, wasn't it? That was
with the pledges that are already on the table. So they will need to be strengthened, as Phil has said, and we're already. If we were to stop emitting greenhouse gases tomorrow, it's already around 1.5 degrees temperature rise. It's locked in due to the inertia of the system, the warming of the oceans. So these are sobering things. These are sobering things, but it strengthens resolve as well.
Phil?
Yeah, look, I think as well as that, which I agree with, the agreement had not done enough to ensure responses to climate change would, A, uphold human rights, the gender equality, and particularly the rights and strengths of Indigenous peoples. You know, so there's a lot more yet to be done. And I think President Tong put it rather succinctly the other day that, yes, 1.5 is definitely a problem for Kiribati. And the Prime Minister of Tuvalu said, well, you know, we're still going to go under the water. But he did say it would be a mistake for us just to view the outcome of Paris with scepticism, you know, or cynicism. And as I've said to you before, John, I've always believed that cynicism is just an elegant form of surrender. You know, there is a pathway here, a way forward that's predicated on hope and also on some, you know, some binding tenets here in terms of process and direction and mechanisms into the future that we didn't have before. But it needs to go to those other issues as well, the things Miriam has spoken about, but human rights, gender equality and the rights and capacities of Indigenous peoples to live on the planet like human beings, for that to be protected.
Gerard.
Yeah, look, I couldn't agree more with the last bit of what Phil said there. There's an issue of rights here, and I would say it's even bigger than the two categories of Indigenous and gender that Phil spoke about. I think there's a third issue there, which is kind of the elephant in the room in almost everything that humans do, and that is the rights of the earth itself, of the biosphere, of nature, which we haven't yet quite come to grips with. I'm involved with an outfit called the Australian Earth Laws Alliance, and one of the things we're looking at is the idea that environments should have standing so that they also have some kind of right within the legal systems.
An inherent right to exist.
Yes. Mm. In other words, a river has the rights to be a river, a forest has the right to be a forest, a mountain has the right to be a mountain, and that we need to some degree, to measure what we do in line with that. Now, from a spirituality point of view, that's 100% consistent with the spirituality of the Indigenous people of Australia, the Noongar people here in Perth, and I pay my respects to the Noongar elders, past and present, of this land where I am right now. And those people have a spirituality that utterly respects every aspect of the environment in which they live. You know, the tree is their brother, the rock is their brother, the grasshopper is their brother, the bird in the air is their brother, the clouds are their brother, the stars are the spirits of others that might come to be born one day. So that there's this intimate relationship of identity, which in some respects the Western world and the Christian world and many of the other major religions have kind of lost contact with at the time that we invented agriculture, it seems. But when you dig right down into our faith traditions, the germ of all that is still there, and that is something that we could awaken. And I think that if we can uphold human rights in terms of Indigenous rights and gender rights and so on, that's absolutely paramount, because if we don't do that, we won't be able to recognise any other kind of rights either. But I think that ultimately humanity needs to broaden its view of who it is, to see that we are part of the biosphere. There's not us over here and the biosphere over there, that we need to start functioning as a contributing part of that biosphere in the way that all the other organisms that we see when we go out into nature behave. We need to learn to do that. We used to do that, but somehow we forgot. That's something we need to reconnect with.
It's an extraordinary thing that perhaps 50 years ago, certainly the 1960s, biology textbooks in schools began to be written on an ecological basis. Yet it's taken this long for that to sink through as an issue of political substance in the discourse of the country. One has to be a bit pessimistic about some of this.
Yeah, but there are challenges here too. I think one of the traps we've probably fallen into is that you've had people working for human rights over here, working on human rights, people working for the environment rights, working over here on that area, people working in development, human development over here, often in silos. And the challenge coming out of this is for that to be fused and for people to start working for the whole picture.
And that was what Laudato Si did too.
That's right,
wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And so that's the challenge for the sector and for those in the movement.
Let's talk about Australia. Yes,
I was just going to add as well, I mean, I think when we look at what's going on some of the frontiers of the expansion of fossil fuel, and especially unconventional fossil fuels, we're seeing movements that bridge a whole lot of that spectrum growing now and growing across the world, wherever that expansion is taking place, coal seam gas, unconventional
farmers
oil.
Walking out and so, yeah, coal seam
we saw
gas.
That in the streets of Paris too. You know,
really?
Absolutely. Despite the fact that people were threatened not to go out into the streets, and it wasn't just on a single issue, it was about all of that. And that was, again, in that context, it was pretty inspirational to see.
Seth, you were a leader of one of the climate marches here in Sydney, were you not?
Yes. And I was just actually going to comment on the People's Climate March when you were talking about, collaboration and working together, because that's just what the People's Climate March was all about, was actually bringing different sectors of the community together, united in one common cause. And what was significant about the Sydney March was the number of Pacific Islanders that were actually part of the march and at the front line of the march, and to actually mobilise the diaspora communities here to actually get excited and get engaged about climate change and what's happening to their brothers and sisters in the Pacific was an incredible thing. And what that's actually started is that Pacific Islanders in the diaspora are now wanting to explore how they might be more engaged, both politically, theologically, and in other ways to help their brothers and sisters in the Pacific, because they do understand and know that they are the fortunate ones that, well, for now at least, that they live in a country that has the resources to, deal with climate change, but they also understand or beginning to understand that they now occupy a public space in which they can advocate for their brothers and sisters in the Pacific. So this is exciting times, I think. You know, it's devastating circumstance, but exciting times in terms of bringing different sectors of the communities together.
We're seeing a reawakening of a political consciousness, if you like. Mm. Politicians have responded. Globally, they've responded. Now it passes into the hands of bureaucrats. If we're in the Australian context, some have already said that the current set of Australian figures have been manufactured by bureaucrats to suit a political end. They don't represent any form of substantial reality. Mm. We have to come to terms with that. Gerard, your observation.
Yeah, 100% spot on. They are exactly that. I think that most of the words that have come out of our leaders, unfortunately, have been window dressing. You know, the idea that we're among the leaders in the world in terms of dealing with climate change becomes some kind of a fiction. When you look at a graph of the G20 per capita emissions, we're right up there with the US. With Saudi Arabia at 16 tonnes. Per person per annum, you know, when the Swiss are running at about 3.7. Now, you know, if the Swiss can run at 3.7, then, you know, with a highly civilised country, then we ought to be able to, in spite of our distances and stuff, because we have a lot more sun and wind and stuff than they do. So I think that, you know, there's no doubt that the government is going to have to bite the bullet and look at the politics of the whole situation and change things. You know, they're going to have to look at different forms of emissions reductions. We're definitely going to have to leave all the coal in the ground. We're going to have to stop clearing our forests. You know, the mad purge of clearing that's been happening in Queensland since the previous government came in and opened that all up again has been kind of nuts. Some farmers seem to be doing preemptive clearing in case the rules change and changing and clearing stuff that they might even have left before. We're going to have to stop destroying habitats and forests because there's a huge amount of carbon comes out of those, almost as much as out of transport. I think Australia is going to need, now that the world is looking at various forms of trading, Australia is going to need to sort of look again at some kind of mechanism for people who pollute to pay. And the other thing we're going to really have to look at is to cancel our Kyoto carryover, that Kyoto Protocol carryover that we have, and we're going to have to increase our post 2020 reduction targets by a long way. And one of the significant things that we could do would be to remove the subsidies from fossil fuels, which I believe are something in the order of, I don't know, $9 to $11 billion a year or something. If that sort of money was invested into renewables in this country, vast parts of Australia could be self-sufficient by 2025. And with the technologies becoming so much cheaper, and I mean, you could virtually, for about $10,000, you could virtually go off-grid nowadays, and the way that they're administrating the grids, people will be encouraged to do so, I suspect. But, you know, the costs are coming down. The benefits of those investments are going up. And so, you know, we have amazing opportunities, for Australia particularly, we have amazing opportunities because all the answers we need to achieve the ambitions of Paris are already known. And most of them actually provide us with a better outcome. The Anglican Church Synod here in Perth voted the year before to divest from fossil fuels, and that process is well underway. And I know the Uniting Church has done the same. These sorts of things are perhaps not huge gestures, but they provide a kind of a moral background against which politicians can judge the things that they're going to do, and it makes them start to question things, and it makes the people in the pews and the people who read about this in the paper have a bit of a think about where their priorities are. So there's a tremendous amount of moral leadership that can come from organisations like ours at all sorts of levels. All of these people that took part in the climate march, those huge community organisations across that incredible breadth, all of these people can have an influence to shift our society. I think the will is there. I think there's definitely the will there. The technology is there. So really it's a case of persuading our government and getting our government to get the bureaucrats to shift gear, because I think even the bureaucrats probably already know what they need to do if they're allowed to do it.
Miriam, we have a Minister for Climate Change who's well qualified in this area. Indeed, he's got a PhD in the area.
It's not just the bureaucrats, is it? I think that's the thing. I mean, the role that climate change has played
critical linchpin in the political process in the last couple of elections.
That's right, that's right. And I guess, you know, our country is not the only country where these issues have such a partisan divide, but it's it's particularly strong in Australia. I mean, what does one say? I think one has to build a very strong social movement, and that's where the change will come from. And we're seeing that start through the People's Climate March, through other movements on the ground that are resisting fossil fuel infrastructure, that are calling for the kinds of changes that Gerard is talking about. I think that's where it is. It's not a matter of going and only meeting with these people, with these politicians. It's about that broad-based social movement that will call for changes.
Does the Prime Minister and the Minister for the Environment, do they have the intellectual grasp of the issue, Phil, well, do you believe?
I think they do, but they don't. What they don't have is the political commitment. I think they're, to put it in raw political terms, I think they're scared of the 30% of the backbench that see themselves as the government in exile, led by the former Prime Minister, and the shock jockery of Sydney Morning Radio and the Murdoch Press, who are completely out of step with the rest of the world. If 195 countries come together to agree to say this is about the future of our planet, well, frankly, Morning Sydney Radio hosts and the Murdoch Press protesting against that.
And really, Donald Trump.
Well done, John. We've got the trifecta. I think really, they're in a very diminishing minority. We just need politicians to have the guts to stand up. And one of the more shameful parts of what went on in Paris from our own leadership was the fact that a big announcement about our commitment to climate finance, which was actually just a shuffle of the diminishing aid budget. Yeah. You know, this is a new and emerging issue.
That's a good example. Let's go into a little detail about it and explain that to people who haven't heard, that there was a major announcement on the time that the Paris Agreement was signed in the water. There it was, and Australia said, yes, we're going to commitment by making a major commitment to Paris, to climate change. And people the next day found out that it actually wasn't a new commitment. It was just shifting money out of the already horrendously depleted aid budget.
And it wasn't a new commitment. It was what we signed up to do a number of years ago. We were providing that same level of funding per year. So this notion that this was a big deal, it was a card trick. And one of the things that Australia did in Paris was they didn't block. That was good. But they hid in the long grass. You know, and they led from the back of the bus. And frankly, you know, that let down our Pacific neighbours, I think. But I do have to say that Australia at Paris did play a more constructive role in negotiations, and that was pleasing. But there still remains
a big
gap.
Julie Bishop was pleased to see herself in the front of the pack where she could.
Sure. And I think, you know, she eventually signed up to the coalition of ambition that the Tony de Brum had brought together, the Marshall Islands foreign minister, but there's still a worrying chasm between the government's rhetoric and the reality of their actions. Now, that's got to change, and the world will be watching.
It's interesting to note that on the night that the story broke, that success had been achieved, Channel 7 and 9 and 10 ran the story 10 minutes into their bulletins after the car accidents and everything else.
Sure.
And it was only the ABC and SBS that led with the story.
Yeah, yeah.
And it may be something about where people think the focus of the broad populace is on these sort of issues.
But if the government got on the front foot and took the climate finance issue sensibly and didn't see it as an effective way of public policy to take money away from Bangladesh to put into climate funding, we need much more serious, sensible policy than that.
Seth, has the government been serious about the Pacific and what it's doing? Because we know that there are going to be a need to have major population relocation in some of those Pacific islands already. Has the government been upfront and decent on that?
Well, no, I have to agree with Phil on that. I think that there is a disconnect between the rhetoric and actually the action. And I guess, fortunately, our Pacific neighbours know that. They know where Australia stands. And I remember when I first started in this role and going to leaders' meetings, and it was actually quite embarrassing for a while because Tony Abbott was our Prime Minister at the time. And having, Pacific church leaders look at me because I'm there representing Australia and saying, what's going on with you guys? You know, don't you kind of get what's happening, with climate change in the Pacific and that you could do more and why aren't you doing more? So I think that, the Pacific, our Pacific partners feel that Australia could do more, but they kind of do understand where we're at. And I think that our government could actually do a lot more, and Australia could play a really critical role in terms of climate justice and climate action. And yes, I think relocation, that's something that I think wasn't, it's in the agreement, but I think it wasn't strong enough in terms of what happens, what do we do with people when they actually lose their homes. And it's not just a matter of moving people, we're actually having to deal with identity, with sovereignty, you know, and also particularly in the Pacific, you've got land people and ocean people. And when you're relocating them, you kind of have to think about where you're going to put them, because there's no point putting sea people in a land without giving them the skills to actually adapt and, you know, make homes. So it's a very complex issue, and I think that that's something that's not very strong in the agreement in terms of what we do with relocation long term.
You're on Sunday Nights on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia via the web to the world. We're discussing Paris, the agreement on climate change, how much substance is there, how much is yet to do. Our guests are Dr. Miriam Pepper of the Uniting Earth Web, also from the Uniting Church, the Reverend Dr. Seth Carroll, Uniting World's Manager of Church Partnerships for the Pacific, and in Perth, our Perth studio, Jared Sierra, environmental architect and member of the Anglican Eco Care Commission, and also in Sydney, Phil Glendenning of the Edmund Rice Centre in Sydney, who is at Paris. Your turn to give us your say. 1300 800 222. 1300 800 222. Do give us a call. We've got 15 minutes to get some calls in before we have to draw this discussion to a close. 1300 800 222. Gerard, your observations on what's just been said.
Well, look, I'm on the West Coast, so I, even though I grew up in Sydney, I'm a little out of touch with what happens over there. But there's no doubt that wherever we are and whatever we do, we're looking at an issue of justice. We have to provide just outcomes for the people of the low-lying islands. My ancestors come from the Netherlands. They also are at tremendous risk. I have cousins that live 6.4 metres below sea level. God knows what they're going to do when the seas rise by four. How long can you tread water? The thing is that, you know, we have so much to do, but the thing is, as I mean, anybody that's ever read Al Gore's book, Our Choice, or actually bothered to inform themselves about our world's energy and transport systems and so on, will realise that everything that we need to know about how to deal with this issue in terms of energy, in terms of transport, in terms of urban design, our cities are an enormous opportunity for fixing this kind of stuff. We already know, you know, the Australian Institute of Architects through the Sustainable Built Environment Council has already told the Australian government how, by fixing up the buildings in Australia so that they behave better in terms of natural light and ventilation and energy use and so on, we can reduce the energy consumption of our buildings, and the cost to the economy, the penalty we pay for this tremendous renovation of our built environment is a saving of $38 billion a year to our economy. You know, that's an NBN every 12 months that we save if we fix our buildings. And by doing that, we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by about 14% or something. So, you know, there are so many things that we can do we haven't even started to look at. You know, most people don't think about the fact that they could do some retrofits to their house and make a difference, or that they could change their office buildings. And in the city of Perth, the Australian Bureau of Statistics says that we're likely to grow in population by roughly doubling what we've got right now by 2050, which means we have to rebuild this entire city, most of which was built since 1945. We have to build it all over again in the next 35 years. Well, if we build that properly, and if at the same time we embrace the idea of an integrated urban transport network and we locate our buildings where they need to be, then we can do that. You know, like Rob Adams and co. in Melbourne have worked out that they can accommodate a doubling of the population of Melbourne on 7% of the land by concentrating it along transport corridors. We don't need to sprawl our cities the way we're doing right now and creating car dependency and fossil fuel dependency by doing that, and congestion and everything else. There are so many things we can do. And those are justice issues as well for our own people in our own culture. And those things will enable us to then, for instance, some of that $38 billion we save from our buildings could be applied to helping our Pacific neighbours.
It involves the world in a return to recognising the need for the use of brain power in applied planning, which is something that the philosophy of the free market finds rather problematic. Time to take your calls, 1-300-800-222, to David in Hobart first. Hello, David, welcome.
I endorse the idea of carbon dioxide emission reductions, but some of the points I'd make relate to building materials. For instance, if most modern buildings have window frames with aluminium around them, every solar voltaic cell on a roof is in an aluminium frame, and yet many people, when they're advocating energy reductions, would close our aluminium refineries. And so the point I'm making is that a narrow view of energy and energy consumption ignores the bigger picture, which all the consequences flow.
Yes, there are complex trade-offs to be made. Miriam?
Yes, very complex. I guess what it points me towards as well, and, you know, one of the arguments in the environmental movement has been, can you just keep dematerialising and grow the economy? You know, can you decouple those things fully? And some would say, well, yes, of course, you know, we can continue to grow the economy. We just need to keep our material consumption of energy and other material goods, other minerals and so on, down. And others will say, well, we need to fundamentally question that model of continued growth, of continued economic growth. And those whole questions about material throughput really raise those issues. And I think in the papal encyclical speaks a lot about that as well, a growth-based economy, and should we be continuing to do that in already wealthy industrialised nations that have a relatively high standard of living?
But decoupling is not an easy question. David, we're going to have to move on. Thanks for that observation. To Roy in Nowra. Hello, Roy. How are you doing?
Good evening. I'm well, thank you. Everybody has had a lot of input, and it was very interesting to hear it all. My question to the guys is, over the years, we've come up with wind turbines, and they're very, very successful overseas. And in some of the countries where you previously mentioned this evening, where their carbon emission is very low, specialising wind turbines. It seems that every time we decide as a country here to install them somewhere, we get someone on the bandwagon from the green side of it saying, oh, yeah, but it's all the noise that they create and the disruption to the living people and the frogs and all the rest of it in the valleys. Yeah. We have so many places. We've got the wind turbines down there at the old Woodlawn mine site that's east of Lake George between Goulburn and Canberra. Now, we've got a lot of mining in this country that at the end fills up a big hole and has vacant land. Why do we not consider putting it in some of these locations where it is not going to interfere?
Well, we've had half a win on wind turbines. The government said that they're back on the agenda, at least the financial underwriting of them is. Gerard?
Yeah, look, wind turbines are one of the strategies. Australia gets enough sunshine in a sort of a day or two to supply most of the world with energy for a year, so we could quite easily harvest that in a whole range of different ways. I think one avenue that Australia hasn't looked at much yet, although there are plans, people have been looking at building one near Kalgoorlie, is a thing called a solar thermal power station, where they direct the heat from mirrors into molten salt, which raises it to a temperature of many hundreds of degrees so that the station can operate 24 hours a day. So that gets rid of this whole concept of baseload and so on. And so, look, the energy issues are very simple. And I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt, Roy, that the Green Movement is 100% behind wind power. It is a small number of people who are, you know, who have dubious sources of funding, in my view, that are opposed to it. And certainly there's no evidence that it has any problem with frogs or birds or anything else. Look, I'd just like to quickly pick up on something from David from Hobart, and that is that within architecture there's an idea called cradle to cradle, an architect called William McDonough and an engineer called Michael Braungart wrote this book, Cradle to Cradle, which talks about closing all the loops of our material culture, where instead of digging something up out of the ground, processing it, using it, and then throwing it away, because there really is no away, there's only this earth, we can't toss it all into the sun or whatever, what we need to do is actually to use the things that we've used. When we finish using, we disassemble them and recycle everything. Now, if we do that, it solves some of the embodied energy problems in aluminium, because aluminium is one of those things you can recycle endlessly, as is steel, and we can provide enough energy through things like wind and solar thermal and tide and so on to do the smelting of the aluminium that we need to do. So we don't have to burn fossil fuels to create aluminium the way we have in the past, not even for concrete and stuff, I suspect, eventually, because they will invent other forms of concrete. So the energy equation, the material equation, these are things that we can solve, because cradle-to-cradle technology is already established and a number of companies already implementing it. And therefore, it becomes, again, an issue of the political will to do these things. And if we're gainfully employing people, then we ought to be able to find ways through value-adding and service industries and being smart of having an intelligent knowledge and skills economy where most of the wealth in the economy doesn't come from the resources which we extract from the earth and the impacts we impose on the earth, but it comes from the exchange of skills and value-adding along the way. And when we do that, we also have the opportunity through equity in terms of income and a whole range of other things to create a much more equitable distribution of goods and wealth throughout the planet, because at the moment there's a pretty bad imbalance there. So this is a wonderful opportunity for us to not only address the technologies but also to address the inequities in the current way we do things in terms of our manufacturing culture.
We've only got a couple of minutes left. What I'd like to do is do a brief round. It seems to me that what everybody's saying is a good start, but we've got to maximise the pressure. And it's the pressure on the politicians, but it's also pressure within our own groups, our own communities, to help them to change their minds where there are reservations and to keep that pressure up. Churches are a key and critical agency for this. They're one of the few bodies that still remain with some grassroots contacts to mobilise. Do you see this as an important... What hope do you give for churches to take this on as both... one could almost see it as a new evangelism, as a way to bring an understanding of spirituality back into the whole debate about who we are and what we are. Seth, very briefly.
Yes. No, it is critical and imperative for churches to embrace this as a prophetic call to do something for the earth, for people and for communities. And I'm hoping that that's something that they will do. But unfortunately, in order to do that, we've actually got to unravel a lot of our history in terms of theology that treats creation and people as two distinct and unrelated things.
Resources to be exploited.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, alongside being prophetic, we've also got to undergo this education, you know, rethinking theology, rethinking God in this whole process, and treating creation as a vital, you know, critical other.
Phil, 30 seconds.
This is the big existential question facing humanity this century. If churches or any civil society group want to be relevant to that humanity, they have to be up to their neck in this.
Miriam?
Yep, I agree with all that. And I think that we address some of those questions of theology and so on. We do that as we act. We do that as we go along. And the other thing as well is that the World Council of Churches, in their press release after this, said that churches have played an important role in the lead up to Paris. And now it's time for you to hold our leaders to account as we implement this. So there's more work for all of us to do.
Thank you to all of us. Gerard, I'm sorry, we've run out of time. Gerard Sierra from the Anglican Church in Perth, Phil Glendening, Miriam Pepper, Seth Carroll, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Night.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.